Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Wellness Wednesday. When the Affordable Care Act takes effect on January 1st, Americans with ear infections, diabetes, or chronic migraines will be covered for doctor's visits and lab tests. But some ailments of the head and heart can't be soothed or cured with a course of antibiotics. About 1 in 4 American adults suffer from a mental illness in any given year. And these afflictions, which include depression and addiction, not only can debilitate, but also cost a lot, including billions of dollars in related crimes and lost work productivity. Because of the stigmas associated with mental illness, seeking help is one hurdle in and of itself, and without insurance, getting it is darn near impossible. But many hope that will change because mental health coverage is included as one of the 10 essentials laid out by Obamacare. Joining us now to talk about the mental health piece of Obamacare is Hugh Wirtz. He's CEO of the Ohio Council of Behavioral Health and Family Service Providers. Welcome to the show, Hugh.
Thank you for inviting me. Glad to be here.
A big part of the Affordable Care Act's mental health provision involves the federal parity bill, which passed in 2008, 5 years ago. What did that bill do to make a difference?
Well, that was something that in the field we've supported for many years. We had limited parity that was passed in Ohio, but the bill that was signed by President Bush, the Mental Health and Addiction Equity Act, was really the culmination of a lot of advocacy, and what it really did was recognize that people with, and I'll use the term behavioral health illnesses to mean addictions and mental health.
Okay.
And what it did for the first time across the country was to recognize that these are chronic illnesses. And that historically, many insurers provided limits, put limits on those services. Those limits may have been financial in terms of higher copays, deductibles, or limits on days of service. We don't do that with cancer. We don't do it with diabetes or any other illness. And these are illnesses that are chronic illnesses. They can be treated with medications, with counseling, with other kind of support services. So the parity bill began to move us in a major way toward recognizing that the head, the mind, the body, they're all connected. They all relate to chronic illnesses.
So why is it important to Obamacare?
Parity becomes very important in the context, and you mentioned before, the essential health benefits, which are part of the exchanges of the marketplaces. And one of the provisions
that
of Obamacare—
That they have to provide.
That they have to provide. And among those 10 essential health benefits, mental health treatment and alcohol drug abuse treatment or addiction treatment are essential health benefits. And those have to be provided at parity. So parity becomes a very important part of making sure people have access to those services. And I think as we look at those marketplaces and the combination of essential health benefits and parity, we're talking about people for the first time getting access to insurance, or, you know, people who didn't have insurance or maybe have had limited insurance. Many of those people are working, could not afford, could not get access to services or to insurance. It also begins to move us in a direction that we've been advocating for many years, and that is moving toward better integrated care. And what I mean by that is making sure that people with behavioral health illnesses and physical illnesses get those services and get access to those services. We know, for example, from national data that was done a number of years ago, in the United States, people with serious mental illness die 25 years earlier than the general population. In fact, Ohio data that was done a few years ago actually shows that number to be closer to 30 years. Now, if we had that situation with any other illness, we would have a huge crisis in this country in terms of an illness. That's not been focused on as much, but part of the reason for that, those numbers, is that many individuals with those chronic mental illnesses, for example, or addiction, chronic addiction illnesses, have not had access to physical health care. We see now more and more people, as we're doing more integrated care, and we have a number of providers doing that more and more around the country, where they embed primary care in the specialty care service, or they have those relationships. Mm-hmm. People who are coming through the door doing blood screens, other kind of screenings, who have never seen a doctor.
Not a thing.
They have the mental health illnesses that now are being treated. But we know from data that was done in this state and California and others that people who have chronic mental illnesses, chronic addiction illnesses, have a higher medical cost than the general, than others, you know, people, for example, who have heart disease. If you look at data on what their cost of treatment is each year compared to someone with heart disease and also a major mental illness, oftentimes the cost of those for that individual is 3 to 4 times higher.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Hugh Wirtz, the CEO of the Ohio Council of Behavioral Health and Family Services Providers, about the mental health component of Obamacare. If you have a question or comment about that component of Obamacare, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. That is because, getting back to what you just said, because of the mental illness, because of the addiction, they don't take their medicine properly, they don't show up for appointments. What's the connection there? Why is it 3 to 4 times more costly?
Well, it's several things. You've mentioned some of those, and I will say another feature in which kind of gets to the point that, or the issue you've just raised, is the need for better care coordination and care management. It really is looking at the full continuum of services, not only treatment, but how do we manage, how do we do early intervention, prevention, how do we do wellness management? And one of the features in Obamacare, a provision allows states to develop Medicaid health homes. Those are funded for 2 years, 8 quarters at 90% match. And we have begun to roll those out in Ohio, Medicaid health homes for people with serious and persistent mental illness. And they, you know, those have a number of features, including integration. They require really that integration. And also to really do care management for those individuals, to look at the meds, to make sure they're keeping their doctor appointments. A person oftentimes who we don't know, we haven't seen in our system, our providers haven't seen, who may be in a hospital or an emergency department, they get discharged. We don't know it. They don't get connected with the service so that someone is looking at the kinds of services they need on an ongoing basis.
And that's a goal of Obamacare across the board, not just for people who have mental illnesses, but people, you know, at the geriatric level, all kinds of things. It's that whole integration they're hoping will be part of what lowers the cost across the board.
Right. And let me just add to that also, and back to what I said before, it really is beginning to connect people with the whole array of services, not just counseling, not just medications, and Medicaid expansion, which is also part of Obamacare, and we're having that debate in this state right now
which,
whether we should do that.
Which at this point is not going to occur at this point.
Right. But really, again, Medicaid expansion provides expanded coverage for families, single adults without children. They may have had children, have no children at home now. That's particularly true on the addiction side, where roughly 20 to 30% of those individuals are eligible for Medicaid. Expansion would provide health care coverage for them. But the other thing that gets to part of your question is that the effects of Medicaid expansion by covering more treatment services that we now pay with state and local tax revenues, it would free those resources up because Medicaid would be paying for those medical treatment services. Then those dollars could be used for the kind of services that become critical for people with chronic illnesses, and that might be housing support, it might be job support, nutrition, wellness management, those kinds of wraparound support services that we have found over the years are critical around in chronic, you know, treating chronic illnesses.
I wonder how it would be integrated into, say, the prison system and that sort of thing, where they're grappling with addiction issues and mental illness, that would give them more resources as well to cope with these problems.
Well, there are limitations on Medicaid being used for people in inpatient or in prison facilities. The issue there, though, is with sentencing reform and people who are in prisons who we really need to look at transitioning into the community and making sure that when we transition those people into the community, we've got the services, the housing, the other kinds of things that will lead to hopefully successful outcomes, getting them back into the workforce and those kinds of things.
We'll address medical professional shortages in coming weeks, but we already know that there's going to be a physician shortage when this kicks in. What are your expectations for mental health counselors and psychiatrists especially? There's a huge shortage of psychiatrists, especially for adolescent males.
Yeah, and I don't have the exact numbers, but you're exactly right. We're very concerned about that. The good news is that if we expand access for people with in terms of insurance access, we're concerned about access in terms of the professionals to treat those individuals. We've got major issues with psychiatrists, particularly child psychiatrists.
Right.
We're seeing, and again, I can't pull out the numbers right now, but we're seeing a significant in the near term, over the next few years, retirements and among nurses, social workers, others who are leaving the field, who've been in the field for a long time, and we're concerned about the incentives, to begin replacing that workforce. The other problem we have, and we're doing some work with the legislature and others, is that right now we don't recognize in all parts of state law or the statutes across all parts of the healthcare system, particularly on the medical side, all of the licensed professionals. On Medicaid, all the licensed professionals, docs, psychologists, counselors, licensed independent counselors, social workers, are all recognized. We don't have those individuals all recognized in the health insuring corporation statutes in the state. And that's a workforce issue because they need to be recognized as eligible to provide service and be paid for those services.
Okay, and that's not dealt with?
And that's something which...
At the exchange level?
No.
Okay.
That is not dealt with.
They're
at
not required
level.
at this point.
Yeah, right now it's really psychologists and doctors and under the supervision of. So, that's, again, it's one of those tweaks that we can, there's the issue of the numbers of people coming through schools into the workforce, but mm-hmm. we have some things we can fix also that at least enhances the utilization and access to the existing workforce.
What about addiction treatment centers? They're already packed. There aren't enough slots as it is. That could pose a problem as well.
Well, part of that, though, again, it's workforce. It's also resources. There's not been a lot of state support for addiction services. Most of the resources come from federal block grant, but the federal substance abuse block grant. But again, the expansion, potential expansion of Medicaid, the coverage under the essential health benefits under the exchanges in the marketplace will really potentially enhance the access and ability of providers to expand capacity.
A long-term problem, regardless of how much money you have, is geography. There's already shortages. There's shortages of psychiatrists and health professionals in urban centers, let alone out in rural areas. What about that component?
Well, and that's always been a challenge in terms mm-hmm. of workforce shortage areas where you don't have people who are attracted to rural areas or other places don't want to work. But I think one of the things that we have to look at more robustly is technology. And that's something that there's been a lot of discussion about in moving forward with telehealth and telemedicine. We're seeing that more and more, certainly in states that are very rural. But we're seeing it in this state also, in terms of major medical centers beginning to make the connections in rural areas through telemedicine, telehealth.
So I could get some counseling via Skype or something like that?
Well, it's not. Yeah, it's more secure than Skype. There's various kinds of technology and we're... There are programs around the country in behavioral health that are very integrated primary care health, mental health care programs that already have used telehealth throughout their clinics that may be located in different geographical locations. But the doctor, the primary care doctor who's seeing a patient who that doctor knows has a significant mental health issue, doesn't know that patient but knows it's there, can make that connection with a psychiatrist, for example, at another site. And that has worked very effectively in beginning then to not only help that patient but also make that connection between the two doctors or other professionals. So I think technology helps that. Again, resources through these various initiatives that are going on now to expand workforce, to create the incentives. It's all part of that equation.
Well, I kind of imagine that we'll be talking again about this as things come to fruition, as the Obamacare takes off. Hugh Wirtz, thanks for talking about it with us today.
Thank you very much. Glad to have been here.
Hugh Wirtz is CEO of the Ohio Council of Behavioral Health and Family Services. Coming up, we're going to talk about e-cigarettes. Thumbs up or thumbs down? If you smoke them, Or if you use them, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back. It's Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Electronic cigarettes have been around for about a decade, but they've only caught on in the last few years, especially among young people. Sure, if you use an e-cigarette, you aren't inhaling a lot of the bad stuff that you get from a real cigarette, but some experts worry that too many kids are just getting hooked on something else. Joining us now by phone from Durham, North Carolina, is Dr. Jed Rose. He's director of the Duke Center for Smoking Cessation at Duke University. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
First of all, could we describe what electronic cigarettes are?
Well, e-cigarettes, which come in a variety of forms, are battery-powered devices that create a mist or aerosol that contains nicotine, usually with a vehicle such as glycerol or propylene glycol and flavorings. And when individuals puff on it, they can inhale something that resembles cigarette smoke, but it is not combusted, and it's not burning like the burning tobacco in a cigarette.
So we know that there's more than just nicotine in these solutions. You just described a few things. What do we know about the effects of the other ingredients? Are they harmless, or do we not know yet?
I don't think we know what the long-term consequences are of inhaling e-cigarette aerosol, and I think, more research needs to be done on that, and the FDA has announced plans to hopefully regulate those products so that they can be characterized in detail, and people will know exactly what they're consuming.
What health concerns do we know about that electronic cigarettes pose that tobacco cigarettes do not? Do we know of any?
I don't know of any significant health concern that we know derives from use of e-cigarettes that wouldn't be obtained from tobacco. And there's good reason to think that actually tobacco smoking causes a lot more disease, just in terms of what the plausible guess is about how things are going to turn out. We need hard data, but we do know that cigarette smoke contains a plethora of poisonous compounds and known cancer-causing agents. Although some e-cigarettes have been shown to contain some levels of some of those agents, generally speaking, cigarette smoke, which contains over 5,000 ingredients, many of which are known to be toxic, are generally thought, I think, to be more likely to pose more hazard. But that's different from an actual proof.
My guest is Dr. Jed Rose. He's director of the Duke Center for Smoking Cessation at Duke University. We're talking about e-cigarettes. Do you use them? Give us a call and tell us how you like them. What do you think? 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We know that a lot of people use e-cigarettes like the nicotine patch to help them quit the real thing. Do e-cigarettes help in the same way as the patch, or are they just, some people think of them as just another crutch?
Well, I think the basic principle that underlies nicotine patches, nicotine chewing gum, lozenge, and e-cigarettes are to replace, the basic principle is to replace the nicotine, which is part of the addiction that smokers have. And smokers, when they try to quit, experience nicotine withdrawal symptoms. The worst mistake that most smokers make when they try to quit smoking is to not use any replacements at all. And then they have roughly a 1 in 20 chance of succeeding in quitting smoking. So it's very important smokers try to use some substitute. Now, nicotine patch, gum, lozenge, and so forth are FDA approved, and evidence has shown that they approximately double or more than double the odds of quitting. We don't have as much evidence yet for e-cigarettes, but in principle, e-cigarettes are replacing nicotine, and if they achieve consistent levels of nicotine, would be expected to work like other products. However, in addition to just the nicotine, research over the years, including a lot of our own research, has shown that smokers are addicted not just to getting nicotine into the bloodstream. They become very addicted to the act of smoking, the feel, the taste of inhaling the smoke. And so e-cigarette technology has the potential of being more effective in replacing some of those other aspects of smoking to which smokers have become addicted. And if it can do it with minimal health risks, then it would be a very promising strategy to end the real epidemic of over 440,000 deaths in this country alone from cigarette smoking.
Is it something that you employ at the Duke Center for Smoking Cessation?
We are not currently employing these in research studies. We're conducting a number of smoking cessation research trials using medications. At the moment, we are not. There are substantial regulatory hurdles in using e-cigarettes at the moment, precisely because it's difficult to specify exactly what is being obtained, how stable and consistent the deliveries are, and so forth. So it's a bit problematic to use them at the current time. But I think in the future, I think a great number of people will start to use them in research studies, and the data will mount in terms of potential efficacy and getting people off the probable worst thing around, which is the burning cigarette.
All right. Walter in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Walter.
Hi. I smoke for 51 years, and September 2011 started using e-cigs, and I haven't had to light a cigarette since. And I've worked in the substance abuse treatment field, so I always felt a little hypocritical, and because I know it's addictive, and I knew that. I tried to stop for years, and I never was able to be successful for more than days at a time. So for me, it's been an absolute godsend.
You said you tried to stop before, just going cold turkey or behavior modification like smoke stoppers, that sort of thing?
I had used both of those. I'd also used the patch.
Mm-hmm.
And I would get, I think the longest I was able to abstain was like 10 days. Mm. And I'd go back. It just almost, like part of who I was. So I think the process addiction, like he's talking about, you get as addicted to how you go about delivering the nicotine, in this case smoking, and I find that the e-cigs totally replaces that, and it.
Oh, looks like we lost Walter there. Dr. Rose?
Yes, uh-huh. That report is exactly the kind of thing we're talking about, where smokers are addicted to other components besides nicotine. The way in which they get it is as important as getting it. The analogy I often draw is with eating a meal. Which would we rather do, get intravenous nutrients into our vein or sit down at a table and eat a meal? Similarly, a nicotine patch is almost, it gets through the skin, but then becomes an intravenous infusion of nicotine, and smokers would rather, quote, eat their meal, that is, puff and inhale the nicotine and feel it going in, also get it in faster to the brain than they get it with other products such as patch and gum. The listener mentioned going 10 days often was as far as he could get. We find in our research about half of smokers cannot even go a single day without smoking, even though they are determined and motivated to try to quit. It is such a potent addiction. So that's why I think these new technologies, which are rapidly evolving, the e-cigarette today is not going to be the e-cigarette of 5 years or 10 years from now. I think they offer tremendous promise for a new avenue to really combat what is an unacceptable situation of huge death and disease burden from cigarettes.
I want to ask you a question, but then I want to go right to an email from a listener that's related. It's interesting. A recent CDC report says that in 1 year between 2011 and 2012, the percentage of high schoolers using e-cigarettes doubled. Although in 2012, almost 2 million middle and high school students nationwide had tried e-cigarettes. Why do you think there's been such a spike in that age group?
Well, I think that people in that age group are generally more experimental and, you know, trying new things. Novelty seeking is more prevalent in that group. In terms of the number or percentage who had used e-cigarettes within the last 30 days, I think the figure was that it rose from 1.5% of kids to 2.8%, and three quarters of them or more were also cigarette smokers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people raise the concern or the alarm that youth may be flocking to this, but we're talking about probably a tiny, tiny percentage of people who are not smokers who may be sampling these things, and there's no evidence yet that they either become addicted to them or that e-cigarettes would become a gateway to more harmful products such as cigarettes. It's complete speculation, but it does emphasize the need for oversight and regulation and monitoring of how these products are used in the real world so they can be appropriately regulated.
We have an email from a listener. They write, I know a lot of young adults that use e-cigarettes for hash oil, too, which is a relatively new way to vaporize hash. So could the same process be used to smoke pot or, in this case, hash?
Well, just as a cigarette can be used as a vehicle to deliver all kinds of drugs, then so could some of these technologies.
The CDC is worried that e-cigs could be a gateway, you mentioned, to the real thing, and it's hard to know. It's young, but California already bans the sale of e-cigarettes to minors, and we know that other states have followed suit in various forms. What kind of impact might that have?
Well, sales of cigarettes to minors are not legal either, but
right.
Minors find ways to get them. So enforcement needs to be more effective, but again, the big elephant in the room is the burning cigarette, to which still 20%, nearly 20% of adults are addicted, and they start mainly as teenagers, and wind up dying prematurely of cancer, heart disease, and lung disease. And even with our best pharmaceutical treatments, long-term success rates are still, in the real world, less than 25%. So even though that we have, quote, efficacious treatments, none of them are all that effective. So we really desperately need innovative new approaches. And perhaps this, generically, this type of technology will turn out to be helpful for cessation. And most experts believe, when it comes to nicotine per se, that nicotine is not the source of the cancer or even the heart disease from smoking. And again, more research is needed to pin down exactly what residual risks there are from nicotine. But so far, there's been very little evidence that nicotine alone, when you take out the carbon monoxide, formaldehyde, arsenic, et cetera, in cigarette smoke, is going to turn out to be substantially different than, let's say, caffeine, which society has accepted as an addiction.
Russell in Canal Winchester, you're on the air with Dr. Jed Rose at Duke University. Welcome, Russell.
Oh, thank you. I listen to your show quite a bit going to work every day, and I enjoy, obviously, everybody's input. And I think that being 21 to get liquor and then 18 to buy cigarettes, I think I'm not quite understanding that philosophy. And I know that the amount of chemicals in certain brands are very high, and that's probably the most top-selling cigarettes out there. So I can take my answer off the air, but I think they need to change the age from 18 to 21 for sure.
Okay, all right. Thanks, Russell.
And if I can interject just on the part of his comment dealing with chemicals in some brands, one widespread myth is that the additives in cigarettes are what cause most of the cancer, et cetera. But the fact is, when tobacco is burned, you generate a lot of toxic compounds. So even so-called natural brands of cigarettes with less additives are certainly not safe.
Just putting smoke in your lungs is just bad.
Right, when it's truly smoke from burning products, yes.
Do you have any sense about whether or not e-cigarettes are geared or marketed toward any particular demographic? We know that Big Tobacco is rolling out their own brands this year. Any concerns about that?
Well, again, I think that speaks to the importance of FDA asserting its jurisdiction under the Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act, which gives them the right to regulate products which are made or derived from tobacco, and the nicotine in e-cigarettes is generally obtained from tobacco. So in time, I'm sure FDA will assert its authority, and then marketing can be regulated, advertising can be regulated, use among youth can be monitored, health effects studied, et cetera, much more easily.
Beth in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
My sister's been a hardcore smoker for a really long time. We both started when we were teenagers. I quit when I was in my 20s, and I did it, you know, the good old-fashioned hardcore method. She has tried kind of, sort of, with other methods, and she's been on the e-cigarettes for a couple of years, and the last time I saw her smoke them, it wasn't as weird as the first time, but I just think that she is just kind of in this fairy tale land that it's not going to affect her the same way that smoking cigarettes did, and she just doesn't want to give it up. So,
Dr. Rose, I mean, you just said that it won't affect her the same way. It's not the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we can definitively say until these are studied and we know exactly what the constituents are and the long-term health effects are. But I think it is very likely that they will turn out to be far less harmful than cigarettes. And most people in the field think that it is likely, but the evidence needs to be gathered.
Thanks a lot, Beth, for that call. Dr. Jed Rose, thanks for joining us today to talk about this. We appreciate it.
Well, it's a pleasure. I was born in Dayton, Ohio. Always nice to talk to fellow Buckeyes.
All right. Dr. Jed Rose, he's director of the Duke Center for Smoking Cessation at Duke University. Coming up, more mind-body issues. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Despite the apparently manic behavior of young children after cake and ice cream at a birthday party, the myth of the sugar rush has been largely debunked. But scientists delving into the mind-body connection are finding that early nutritional habits set the stage for later mental habits and the other way around. OSU researchers this week published the results of a study that found that adding a mental health component to school-based health programs improved teens' nutritional choices, lowered their alcohol consumption, increased their physical activity, and decreased their rates of depression. Here to tell us more about the study is its lead author, Bernadette Melnick. Dr. Melnick is Dean of OSU's School of Nursing and Chief Wellness Officer for OSU. Welcome back, Bern.
Thank you, Anne. Good to be here.
So this study was testing an in-school program. It was called COPE. Almost 800 teens participated. What does the curriculum focus on and how is it delivered?
Well, one of the weak links our team believed in healthy lifestyle interventions for adolescents is the fact that they haven't traditionally incorporated a strong mental health cognitive component to them. So if you take a look at other interventions that have been tested, they all have nutrition education in them, which is very important, a physical activity component, but a lot of them have had behavior modification strategies in them. And what we have seen is that those don't lead to long-term positive outcomes. So we took key concepts from cognitive behavior therapy and pared them down to what I call cognitive behavior skills building.
Give me a distinction. Tell me the distinction between behavior modification and this mental health component you're talking about.
Sure thing. Behavior modification principles basically say, if I do this behavior, I will get this reward. So it doesn't have this central cognitive piece to it, like cognitive behavior skills building. In that, we teach the teens that how they think directly relates to how they feel and how they behave.
That's kind of heavy for a teen. There's a lot of people that don't do well with counseling and that sort of thing until they're older and more mature. Teens are a tough group.
They can be a, what I call character building group, but it's actually my area of specialty. I love that teenager group and the college age group, because I think there is so much that we can teach them that will translate into healthier lives as they get older. And these concepts and truly are relatable concepts that we can even teach grade school children.
Kids today, kids always have been very self-conscious during those, particularly going into the junior high and teenage years. How do you get them to buy into this? Because looking like you're buying into something like this might pose its own set of problems.
The teenagers actually love this program. We teach them what we call the ABCs in the program. We teach them to monitor for activator events. That's an event that happens that triggers a negative belief. And I'll give you an example of that. Somebody calls a teen's art project weird. And a common belief that would follow that would be, I'm no good at art. I can't do anything right. And as a result of that thinking, they get down, they get sad, they don't feel good about themselves, and they might give up and not try so hard anymore. So what we teach the teens to do in this program is to pick up those activator events, and as soon as they start into a negative thought, turn that thought around to something more positive so that they feel better and engage in healthier, more productive behaviors.
Does this course use a lot of role playing?
It does use a lot of case study examples of the common stressors that teenagers face during the adolescent years. And again, teaches them how to cope, how to problem solve, how to set goals, and very importantly, how to think more positively.
You followed up with the teens in the study, and the COPE group saw lasting improvements in health even 6 months later. Tell me what you mean by lasting improvements.
Yes. Well, we saw the trends in the COPE group. Let's take, for instance, the overweight and obesity. We had fewer adolescents in the COPE group move to being overweight and obese than the teens who were in the attention control program who didn't get the active elements in COPE.
And how long, when you say lasting improvements in health, even 6 months later, meaning 6 months later was a long time, what's your hope for how long those improvements last?
A lifetime.
Well, for a lifetime,
yeah,
of course.
A lifetime.
But what's your expectation? When do you think they may need a recharge or a tune-up?
That's an outstanding question, because we won't know at what points, as they continue to mature and develop, could they use booster sessions of COPE. But I will tell you, when you look at, we teach teens math and science and history and social studies, and I'm not saying those aren't important, but if every teen across this country, and we've got about 25 million teenagers throughout the United States, if we could integrate just these 15 sessions in their health course, which they're required to take anyway, and get even some improvement in these particular outcomes, it would be fantastic.
A lot of negative thoughts are intensified or recur when you start college. it's such a change. A lot of kids hit the brick wall. They didn't know they weren't the best writer around, or there's a lot of brick walls in college for a lot of kids because they're coming up against, you know, the reality of it. What about college?
We actually refined COPE for freshman college students at Ohio State last fall. Mm. And we delivered it through an online mechanism. And we are studying what the effects of that program are over time with those particular college students. And I think we have learned a lot about how to deliver that to college students. But again, I think you're right. If we could provide our incoming freshmen with a skill set and a program that could help them deal with the typical stressors that college students face, we could enhance performance throughout their college years and hopefully retention, graduation in a shorter period of time.
Which is a huge goal at Ohio State University.
Absolutely.
What about pushback? Some people think still that psychiatry and psychology is voodoo. And that's not to say anything against voodoo, but they don't believe in it. They may not want their kids to be exposed to this kind of a program. Have you had any pushback in that way?
I have not encountered that. And we had piloted this in schools in Rochester, New York, in Phoenix, in rural West Virginia, before we did this full-scale trial. And I will tell you, the comments that we have gotten back from the teens, besides the quantitative measures that we administered in the study, we have hundreds of comments from the teenagers, from the parents, about how much this program has helped their teens.
When it comes to the reporting on the rate of depression, is that self-reporting? How do you measure that?
Yeah, it is a self-report tool that we use. It's a valid and reliable measure of depression. It's 20 items. It's a screening tool. And again, I caution people about that because a screening tool is a first good step in terms of identifying particular issues, but it shouldn't replace good clinical interviewing.
Sitting in a class and learning about the connection between obesity and mental health sounds interesting, unless I'm the kid who's obese. School is a tough place to be out of place.
Right.
And what have you found about that?
Well, I think this is a very interesting question as well, because we did one of our pilot studies just with overweight and obese teens who benefited a lot from the COPE intervention. But they also told us, if you single us out, we almost feel like, and they use these words, the fat kid club. And so they were the ones that said, Byrne, really? Every teen needs this program. So if you were able to integrate it into the regular health curriculum, you're not going to have kids feeling stigmatized because all kids need this content.
And as you said, that there's a certain marginal number of them that will become obese or overweight. And if you can even stop that, it's a success.
Oh, you bet. One out of three children and adolescents are now overweight or obese. And the CDC has said by 2050, one out of three people will have diabetes. So we have to treat this urgently, and we have to do it preventatively in large part so that we don't get as many children and teens moving into those overweight and obese categories.
An email from a listener, they write, what is the plan to expand the use of COPE in Columbus, for example? New reports suggest a large number of shootings in Columbus are committed by those under 21. Is the COPE program something that will directly affect the behaviors of a whole community throughout life?
I think it could potentially have that promise and that ability. I will tell you, we are piloting the program right now in Olentangy Middle School, one of the Olentangy Middle Schools here in Columbus. And we also have Huntington Middle School in Chillicothe, who has been integrating COPE into their curriculum with their sixth graders this entire past year, and they're continuing to do it this year with their sixth, seventh, and eighth graders.
What do you expect, what are you anticipating or predicting as far as the different socioeconomic levels of those two schools? Any kind of differences, any kind of impact?
Yeah, we are seeing the same beneficial outcomes across socioeconomic status and also across culture, which I think is really important because we have administered the program now in inner city urban environments, in suburbia, in Phoenix, where you have a high proportion of Hispanic
right.
youth, and now in Appalachia, and seeing again very good positive outcomes across the spectrum.
You have said that teachers don't need to be therapists to do this, that you can teach them the skills they need to deliver the message. But do you train them to watch for and intervene on behalf of at-risk students? Are they taught to see if something clicks and the right or wrong way?
Yeah. As part of the workshop that we do prior to implementation, and what's so cool about the program, Anne, is everything is manualized. So the teachers have a manualized book. The students have this entire content and skills building manualized. So it is easier to adhere to the integrity of the program because everything is reproducible. But during the workshop, we also talk to the teachers about how do you spot real issues with depression? When do teens need to be referred? Because frankly, who gets the most attention in schools? It's kids with externalizing or acting out behaviors, not so much teens who have internalizing problems like depression, stress, and anxiety, which can really alter performance, academic performance in school.
Did you see any extreme situations where the program brought out things in kids that were life-changing?
Yeah.
I mean, not that obesity or not being obese is life-changing. That's one thing. But just things, kids who are being abused, kids who are being neglected, that sort of thing.
Well, there's a very strong effective communication part to the program as well, encouraging the teens to find a connection with somebody that they can relate to. And also, we talk about the signs of depression. I mean, when should they let somebody know about how they're feeling? Or if a friend says, I want to kill myself, you know, so many of these kids don't report that to somebody else because they don't want to betray a good friend. So it's teaching them not only about signs and symptoms of worrisome conditions, but also what to do, where to go for help if they confront that.
And did you have any examples of kids doing that?
That's
one of the toughest things.
It is. Well, when we screen for depression, because that was part of the study,
yeah.
We assess depression at baseline. The kids who did fall into the severe depression category, those kids we referred immediately to school counselors. But I will tell you, in the schools we were in, some of those high schools had 3,000 to 4,000 students with one mental health counselor. Now, there is no way we can get treatment, especially evidence-based treatment, to 1 out of 4 kids who have a mental health problem. And again, that's why programs like COPE are so important to give kids the skills that they need to do better through the stressors of adolescence.
And all of this is coming to the fore now that schools are overwhelmed by report cards on the schools, on the teachers, standardized testings for the kids. This isn't where schools are headed right now. They're headed in another direction.
I have a view on that. I think we're showing that an intervention like this can not only improve or prevent moving to overweight and obesity, but the kids in this program had higher social skills, higher academic competence and performance. So the more we can link these types of programs to those academic outcomes, which is what schools are being held accountable for, the easier that uptake is going to be. And in prior studies, a lot of these lifestyle intervention studies haven't measured academic performance, social skills, things like that, to really show teachers, school principals, school superintendents that by offering this type of program, not only can you benefit physical health and mental health, but you can benefit academic performance.
And we're also in an age of huge cutbacks. Districts across the country are being asked to do more with less. It costs money to do this kind of thing. This is an extra. What's your argument to school boards about why it would be an important way to spend their money?
Well, the return on investment is huge. If you have more kids who are depressed, who act out, who don't know how to cope, they're going to be suspended. They're not going to do well in academic performance. So again, I think you have to tie this to outcomes that the schools are most interested in. And I think that's what our research has done very differently than other studies.
Bern Melnick, thanks so much for joining us again.
My pleasure.
Bernadette Melnick, she's dean of the School of Nursing at OSU and is OSU's chief wellness officer. We'll have a link to the article about the study we were just talking about at WOSU.org/allsides. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher, listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.